Well, good morning. It's good to see you again. We begin, as we always do, with prayer. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Father, awaken in us that desire for you which is within each of us and is truly the greatest desire of our life. Direct our thoughts and words today by your holy inspiration, and bring us to understanding through the light of your Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen. For me, one of the strangest times in the year is the daytime, that is the morning and afternoon of Holy Saturday. There's no daily Mass that day. Christ is in the tomb, and the disciples have run away. Although I'm a priest, on this day of waiting I have to live as if God is dead. So let us, just this once as we approach that strange day before Easter, allow the atheists out to play. Let us listen to them trying to explain to us not just that God is dead, but that he never existed at all. Now, I realize I'm taking a bit of a risk doing this. If you are convinced by the arguments of the atheists, you'll be writing to the bishop straight after my talk and asking for the money that you gave to the Catholic appeal back. Now, we as believers are theists. Theism is belief in God. Atheism is the opposite, the conviction based on reasoning that there is no God, that this world is all there is. It's actually quite rare because most people have not really pursued reasoned argument in either direction. When pressed, most people admit that they simply don't know. And those people we call agnostics. Agnostic simply means not knowing. The atheist task is not an easy one because religion is still very popular in most parts of the world, especially in the developing world where the population is still growing. A friend of mine, actually the bishop who ordained me, was the papal nuncio, that is the Pope's ambassador in Sri Lanka. He told me that one of the problems they had there was that on big feast days, when a big public mass was celebrated out of doors because there were such crowds, everyone wanted to go to communion. Not just the Catholics, but the Hindus and the Muslims and the Buddhists as well. The people there just love any kind of religion, so everyone in the town would come to the Mass. In America, we know that since the pandemic, there's been a decline in religious practice. But surveys report that most people, over 80%, still believe in God. So the atheist has to explain, where does this sense of God come from? Now, there are two main approaches. Some suggest that the idea of God is a mild form of madness, largely favored by people of weak minds. The other approach is that religion is a clever way of getting people to behave themselves, a way of getting them to accept the rules and restraints which a successful society needs. We'll look at both these types of atheism, but first I want to introduce you to the granddaddy of all atheists, Ludwig Feuerbach. He lived from 1804 to 1872, and his portrait shows the kind of man that you would imagine a German philosopher to be. A self-important air, a massive beard, and a thoughtful, slightly bad-tempered frown. Rather strangely, his work became known in England because it was translated by a lady novelist called Mary Ann Evans. She wrote under the name George Eliot. Feuerbach was convinced that the idea of God was a human invention. His thought can be summed up in two sentences. First, what man is in need of, he makes his God. What man is in need of, he makes his God. By this, he meant that we tend to be frightened of life, and so we need the comforting thought that life has a purpose, that there is someone in control. The consequence is that our imagination creates a God figure who will look after us and make us happy. That's why the idea of God has sprung up all over the world. People everywhere are needy and they want reassurance. But Feuerbach also went on to explain why people have different visions of God. He wrote, "What man wishes to be, he makes his God. What man wishes to be, he makes his God." We imagine this God to be a perfect version of everything we would like to be. Perfectly good, perfectly intelligent, perfectly loving. In other words, we project all the best qualities of humanity onto this imaginary superhuman being beyond this world. The different gods of different religions will have a lot in common then. But Feuerbach pointed out that you'll also get a certain amount of local variations, because different cultures will not have the same ideas about what is most noble in humanity. Thus, in the Mediterranean world, where they have a good idea of what life is about, they have a god of wine, Bacchus. The ancient Germanic tribes who valued the virtues of a strong warrior had violent warrior gods like Thor and Odin. And in India, where an elephant rather than the dog is man's best friend, you have an elephant god, Ganesh. In that sense, religion is comforting. It gives people a common identity, and it's pretty harmless. However, Feuerbach thought that this projection of good values onto an outside being had left humans with a lack of self-esteem, feeling weak and sinful. And so he declared it was time to get rid of the imaginary God and discover our own true value. So for Feuerbach, you know, this idea of God kept human beings immature and weak, and it was time to get rid of God. Now, Feuerbach was an important influence on the founder of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud, who worked in Vienna and then at the end of his life in London after being expelled by the Nazis. Freud also saw religion as a comfort, a variant of the obsessional behavior which is quite common when people are feeling stress. You know the kind of thing. People go and check the gas or electricity is switched off 3 or 4 times before leaving the house, even though if you really ask them, they know that they've done it already. In the same way, Freud thought people prayed or performed religious rituals to give them a sense of controlling the world. In addition, Freud developed an amazing story to explain why God is so often thought of as a father figure. You know, God is the father in Christianity, in Judaism, for the Muslims. And he wanted to explain why there's this obsession with the father. Now, he was writing at a time when people were discovering the first human remains, Neanderthal man and so on. There was a kind of obsession about early humans, and there was even competition between different nations. You know, the Germans had discovered this Neanderthal man, a kind of very, very primitive version of humanity. And in England, a kind of trickster said he discovered an even earlier man in England. And everyone was very excited about it, you know, and all the scientists were very, the whole thing was a hoax though, you know, he'd made up this kind of human figure out of a monkey's skull and so on. But Freud imagined the very first human group. He didn't say where that would be, but he imagined that somewhere there was this first group of humans. And he called them the primal horde. In this group, there was one dominant male, like you get among groups of animals. The sons respected this alpha male because he offered protection. But as they grew up, they became more and more frustrated because the alpha male kept all the females for himself, just like you get in nature, in fact. Finally, the sons rebelled against the alpha male. And so they killed their father, and then they ate him. Cannibalism. The trouble was that once they'd done that, they felt terribly guilty about what they'd done. And every time they wanted to hurt someone or eat another human being or have sex, the guilt came flooding back. And because the father was gone, he became an image in their minds. What Freud said, you know, this image of the primitive father is our God. Freud thought that all humanity had inherited this guilt. We all get it from the primal horde. And so even now we have mixed feelings about God. We need him, but we fear him. And we feel guilty if we follow our own instincts and act disobediently. Now, Freud himself was Jewish, and he thought that his fellow Jews had a particular tendency to be guilt-ridden. So he looked into the Old Testament for an explanation. He noted that the official story claims that Moses died before the children of Israel reached the promised land. Yes, that kind of sad thing, you know, that Moses looked into the promised land, but God told him, no, you are not going there. You're not going to make it. Freud said that the truth is that the Israelites, angry and fed up with 40 years of being bossed around by Moses, killed him at the very end. You know, they sort of said, oh, here's the promised land. We don't need Moses anymore. Let's get rid of him. However, this reawakened the memory of the primal father killing in their subconscious minds. They were then overwhelmed with guilt. And then they became even more religious. Freud's answer was that we should get rid of the father figure, grow up, feel free. In fact, let it all hang out. In fact, Freud was very much behind the spirit of the 1960s. Although, looking around here, I see a few representatives of the 1960s, you know? And here you are sitting, looking like respectable citizens. Now, Freud's theory is, of course, pretty preposterous, and it was based on no kind of scientific research. Even, you know, the research on the first human beings was very, very vague. First of all, his view of the world is totally male-dominated. His early history of humanity barely mentions women at all. When he wrote about God as a protecting figure, he says, "We imagine him in this way as a great protector because we remember our fathers bending over the cradle and smiling down at us." Now, my memory tells me that it was much more likely to be a mother who took an interest in us at that cradle stage, with fathers keeping a safe distance. I know it's kind of fashionable now for men to be involved and, you know, change the diapers and all that kind of thing. But I think you'll find men managed to keep out of all of that for the whole of history until about 1990 or something like that. So, you know, this obsession with the father, I don't think it really matches up to reality. As for his attempts at history, his description of early humanity is a complete fabrication. There was no evidence of a primal horde. And also, there is no evidence, of course, that Moses was murdered. You know, Moses certainly disappears before the Promised Land, but it does say that he was over 100 years old, so it can maybe not surprising. Now, for me at least, Freud's psychological argument fails to prove that God does not exist. I do not accept that God is a creation of the mind with no reality outside ourselves. Yet I can see why Freud has convinced some people. The thought of God is a comfort. And doubtless, people often turn to God for the wrong reasons, coming to church in times of trouble, but forgetting about God when all is going well. We're probably all guilty of that to a certain extent. You know, we don't pray as much when everything is going great as when things are going bad, you know. When suddenly you discover if you're sick or something like that, you redouble your prayers. Similarly, religious behavior can sometimes be neurotic, but that does not mean religion always stops us from growing up. Rather, I think normally it challenges us, making us less selfish and more fully human. Feuerbach was right too that our image of God is influenced by our culture. But again, that does not mean we have invented him. Inevitably, we can only work within the limitations of our own human minds. Thus, recently, Jesus was portrayed as a revolutionary, totally at the other end of the scale from the royal image of him, which was popular in the early Middle Ages. But the fact that our view of God changes has no bearing on his existence. You know, in fact, there's something rather beautiful about the way different cultures look at God. You know, sometimes it's a little bit absurd. You know, in Victorian books, Jesus was always portrayed as fair-haired and blue-eyed, which he almost certainly wasn't. But, you know, you have different images of the Blessed Virgin Mary, for example. You know, Our Lady of Guadalupe is quite distinctly a native Mexican, you know, not a Spanish-looking person at all, not European, you know. She is definitely from Mexico, a tribal person. And, you know, in China, for example, Our Lady is depicted as Chinese-looking. And, you know, that's an expression that God is incarnate in a particular culture, and we want to recognize him in a particular culture. Now, Freud was not the only philosopher to be influenced by Feuerbach. Another disciple was Karl Marx, who used Feuerbach's ideas to develop a sociological argument against the existence of God. Marx was intrigued by the thought that the idea of God gives us a sense of security. In his early lifetime, he'd seen vast factories in Germany and the cotton mills in Manchester, and he knew that life there was absolute hell for the workers. It was a terrible life. You know, in the cotton mills, they used young women to dress the cotton and everything. And it had to be in a very damp atmosphere. For some reason, that was better for the cotton. But it was damp and cold. And so these young women, they nearly all died, within a few years. And so he said to himself, why didn't the workers struggle to make life better for themselves? Why didn't they revolt against the factory owners? Marx thought that the answer lay in religion. That's the origin of his famous phrase, religion is the sigh of the oppressed. It is the opium of the people. I'm sure you've heard that phrase before. Religion is the opium of the people. Religion, like opium, could take away the pain of the working life by promising workers a better life in heaven. You know, one kind of comment on this, there was a hymn popular in America sort of at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, in the sweet by and by, you know, it was sort of saying, when we get to heaven, everything's going to be all right. And there was an early union agitator, a communist here in America. He rewrote it and said, there will be pie in the sky when you die. You know, don't worry, he said, you know, very ironically saying, don't worry if everything's miserable here, there'll be pie in the sky when you die. That was a man called Joe Hill. But Marx noticed, like a drug, religion made the workers weak. And so they were unable or unwilling to do anything to change their situation. You know, by promising them everything will be all right in the end, it kind of held them back. It stopped them from rebelling. And Marx noted that the ruling classes used religion to keep the workers in their place. And certainly in Russia, which he knew, the priests were closely linked to the royal family, to the aristocracy. But even in Britain, and in the famous industrial town, I'm not sure where it is, whether it's Illinois or Ohio, called Pullman, where all the Pullman trains were made, it was Chicago. Factory owners paid for churches to be built. So they had these industrial towns completely dedicated to industry with housing for the workers, but always with churches there. And he thought that, you know, they were building these churches in the hope that the workers would learn the lesson of humility, docility, and obedience. Now, there's a famous English hymn, maybe you've heard it, "All Things Bright and Beautiful." It's like a children's hymn in a way. All things bright and beautiful, all creatures great and small, all things wise and wonderful, the Lord God made them all. Now, it's published in 1848, and it mainly praising God for the beauty of the world, but it also contains these words: "The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate, God made them high and lowly and ordered their estate." In other words, this is where you're meant to be. You know, there's the rich man, there's the poor man. God made you like that. Don't complain about it. God ordered your estate. Now, if you think, actually, we heard not so long ago as one of the Lent readings, the rich man and Lazarus, you know, there's the poor man at the gate. But Jesus doesn't say, you know, that's all right. Now, Marx accused the rulers and the factory owners of brainwashing the workers by such teaching to make sure that the revolution would never come. Conversely, Engels, Marx's disciple, said that once the people have freed themselves by taking possession of all means of production, they would no longer need the comforting illusion of God, and so religion would simply die out. Now, again, I think we have to recognize that Marx's theory has an element of truth in it. Religion can be used as a way of control. You know, one time I was a teacher of religious education in a Catholic school in London, well, actually two Catholic schools. And they were in quite rough areas of London. And you know, you learn that you can use religion to control children. You know, sometimes when you go in, and in England they always said, if it's a windy day, the children will misbehave themselves. You know, you go into a classroom, all the children are talking and making a terrible noise, you can't get them to shut up. So what you do is say, and now let us say a prayer. And they all have to be quiet at that point. So you can use religion as a control of people. But the fact that people misuse religion like that does not mean that God does not exist. God and religion are not identical. Marx thought that priests and ministers would always support the regime that they lived under. And at times, that may have been true. There may have even been the occasional Catholic bishop who has not refused dinner at the tables of the great and the rich. But none of them, I hope, are mere lapdogs. In fact, the social teaching of the Catholic Church in the context of modern industrial society goes back to Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum in 1891. 1891, that encyclical Rerum Novarum, it means the new things. And he was looking at the development of industrial society. The Pope told employers, and here I'm quoting from the encyclical, not to look upon their work people as their bondsmen, in other words, the slaves, but to respect in every man his dignity as a person ennobled by Christian character. To misuse men as though they were things in the pursuit of gain, or to value them for their physical powers, that is truly shameful and inhuman. And here Leo XIII began a great tradition of social teaching of the Catholic Church. For Marx and other atheist sociologists, close to God would mean close to society. But a more common experience is that close to God means living at a certain distance from society. Think of monks, nuns, and hermits, but think also of those many holy people who have been actively critical of the societies they live in, from the prophets of the Old Testament to the religious leaders who supported Martin Luther King in his struggle for justice, or to missionaries in South America today. You know, many of the priests in South America today are doing everything they can to help the poor, to, you know, to raise them to a better way of life. Also, when sociologists describe religion as the creation of society, they overlook the fact that the great world faiths have been started with individuals, inspired individuals, rather than with a community. Religion does not come out of society. It's coming out of these inspired individuals. Moses, Muhammad, Jesus, all of them went against the grain of the society of their times. You know, Jesus is always having arguments with the leaders of his time. Finally, you will recall that the communists expected religion to die out when the workers were free. But that did not happen. Didn't happen in Russia. Even when Stalin tried to help the process along by killing thousands of priests and tearing down churches. Stalin was particularly bad at that time in the Ukraine. He hated Catholicism because he considered it as, you know, Western and capitalist. And so all, you know, the churches in Ukraine were closed down. Thousands of priests were killed and, you know, all monasteries and everything like that. But in spite of that propaganda and bribes and bullying, religion did not vanish. And in fact, Putin now has decided to try and, you know, get the Orthodox Church on his side. He said, you know, the Russian Orthodox Church is part of Russian culture, and he wants to encourage the church to kind of strengthen the image of what Russians are. So perhaps religion is not the creation of society, but the creation of God. Well, your friends may be surprised when they ask what you've been doing this morning, and you tell them that you've been listening to arguments for atheism. But as I said, although what they claim contains glimmers of truth, I think you have to admit that, they fall a long way short of proving that God does not exist. I hope that you've been able to see through these atheists and will not be spending every future Sunday on the golf course instead of in church. Feuerbach, Marx, and Freud thought that they were writing God's obituary, but I suspect that God may still be around for quite a time. Okay. All right. Any questions? Let me come to the back here.
What about the Vatican Council? What about the Vatican Council?
question was about the Vatican Council, whether that confronted atheism. There's an obscure phrase in it that says, you must not be sort of seduced by an opinion which is popular at the moment. And that was a reference to communism, not to be fooled by communism. But the Vatican Council has a great deal of moral teaching about war and, you know, caring for the poor. You know, it was kind of revolutionary in that way. And again, showing that religion is not just a prop for the wealthy and the important in society. Hello.
Did C.S. Lewis start out as an atheist or just an agnostic?
I think he was an agnostic, really. Yeah. You know, I don't really know. But, I mean, he certainly had a, C.S. Lewis we're talking about, he certainly had a definite conversion experience, didn't he? And then he placed around him you know, real believers, including J.R. Tolkien.
Actually, did Tolkien convert him more so?
Tolkien certainly had a big influence on him. You know, they were all teaching at Oxford University, and they used to meet in a particular pub and talk about, well, about all kinds of things, but, you know, particularly about religion. And, you know, certainly that was, you know, a big influence. And actually, when I was at Oxford, I lived in a particular residence there, a student residence at one time, and the pub that J.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis used to go to was the closest pub to where he lived. And, of course, in England, there's no problem about having a drink if you're 18 years and up, you know. So I was quite familiar with that. Sadly, that pub was closed. They couldn't make enough money. But they're trying to revive it now. It's a very small pub. It's called the Eagle and Child. You know, these pubs in England all have these obscure names. And I don't know why it was called the Eagle and Child. It might be some kind of religious reference. But anyway, we called it the Bird and Baby.
I just sort of always remember, I don't know who coined the phrase, but there are no atheists in foxholes.
Oh yes, that's a great phrase. There are no atheists in a foxhole, you know. If you are being fired at, you know, by the enemy, you suddenly start praying.
I saw a movie a long time ago. It was a war movie. And I identified with the one character and his one actions as he's in a inflatable going across the river to save the bridge or blow up the bridge, one of the things, but the enemy on that side, and they're shooting and shooting at him, and he's rowing this boat with Hail Mary full of grace, Hail Mary full of grace, Hail Mary full of grace, Hail Mary. And I think that's the way we act sometimes in our own crisis. Is you can't even pray. It's like, but there's that
yes
coming back.
I think, you know, and rightly so. When we're in times of trouble, it's right to turn to God, you know. You know, hearing confessions, you know, in this time of Lent, all of the priests here are hearing a lot of confessions here in this parish and helping in other parishes. And, you know, on the whole, it's kind of people who come twice a year, before Christmas, before Easter. Then you get the sort of really devout people who come every single month and really haven't got any very grave sins. But beautifully, when you have these parish penance services, people come who have not been for 10 years, for 20 years. And often it is because there is some kind of crisis in their life. But we're delighted to see them. I mean, this is, you know, they're returning to God, and God is there for them. God is waiting. All right, I better go and get ready for Mass. God bless.